Today is May 4th, 2021. I am Daniel Erickson, and today I'm interviewing Dr. Anita May over Zoom about Oklahoma Humanities and her experiences with the organization as a part of Oklahoma Humanities' 50th anniversary project. So thank you for joining me again, Dr. May.
Okay, you're welcome. So I will just tell you some of the things that appear to me to be consequential, I guess. I think I mentioned the last time we spoke that the whole idea of making public programming in the humanities available to the general public was the purpose of the state humanities councils when they were founded in the 70s. But no one exactly knew what that meant. And colleges and universities did, you know, things for students, but there was some doubt that the general public was even interested in the humanities. And so the first programs were supposed to be focused on letting history and philosophy, et cetera, place contemporary issues of public policy in perspective. So in the 70s, there were a lot of programs about the Equal Rights Amendment, for example. And then we did this one program in libraries called Limits to Freedom. I think I talked about that last time, which was about censorship of books and magazines and films and everything else. But then we began to realize, and the National Endowment for the Humanities began to realize, and the people in Congress who took care of the agency began to realize that perhaps actually the general public might be interested in something else. And we were getting clamored from project directors or potential project directors that they wanted to do things that dealt with straight history that didn't necessarily have to do with contemporary issues. And so we finally began to do that. And that led in a lot more potential programmers. And we found also that people were extremely interested in history, particularly local history. And this involved then a lot of different project sponsors, especially museums. We have many history museums in the state of Oklahoma, and they began to apply for grants. The art museums did as well. And I would say that the art museums were expected to explain the art, not just hang it. And in the meantime, at the national level, the NEH was doing projects like that and had been doing projects like that. So they were, in a sense, good models for state programming. And so one of the first really kind of blockbuster type of programs that we funded was actually an art exhibit with plenty of explanation that was based on Renaissance art. And that was over at the Philbrook. And it was quite a lovely explanation of Renaissance art. And it was kind of its own blockbuster in the region. And then also over in Tulsa, there was a project director with the Tulsa Arts and Humanities Council that proposed a series of, I guess you would call them, several day, almost courses, but seminars for sure, in dealing with different regions of the world. So there was a program that dealt with the Arab world, another one with Latin America. And in these programs, they had multiple presentations by people in the humanities, in history, in literature, and philosophy. And they also tied these programs in with other organizations. So during the program about India, for example, the library at the University of Tulsa did an exhibit that was based at the Philbrook that featured some of their collections of the novelist Paul Scott, I think that's his name, I'm sorry, didn't look it up, who had a series on India that had just played on public television. So there was a lot of creativity once we loosened up the guidelines and didn't worry about elaborating public policy. Then there were also back in the 70s, we modeled a program on a successful program that was started in Vermont with the Vermont Humanities Council. And the National Endowment for the Humanities was so interested in it that it funded pilot programs in a number of states. And we were interested in it because we'd done that big project with libraries called Limits to Freedom. And it was very difficult to get programs in the smaller towns. And in the larger cities, there were larger institutions that had a lot of people working for them, and they could devote personnel to proposing a project and then running it. But in the smaller towns, the smaller institutions didn't have the resources to do that. So this particular program is called Let's Talk About It. And Let's Talk About It's format was for scholars in the humanities to develop a theme and pick a number of books that would illustrate that theme. And they would write an introductory essay about the theme and the books that they had chosen. And then the funding institution, which in this case would be the local Humanities Council, would fund the program in a local library and fund a scholar to give a brief presentation on each book. And presumably the people who signed up for the project had read the book before they came, and then they would have a little guided discussion, a discussion guided by the scholar who was explaining the book. And so we started that, I think that was back in the 70s, with five programs, five different themes. And we got the Oklahoma Library Association to be the sponsor and picked a project director who would work with the libraries. And we did get projects in five libraries, I think it was. And then we liked the program so much that we did this ourselves. We funded with the Oklahoma Library Association a project director who then tried to spread it to multiple libraries. And that is such a success that that way of doing programs in local libraries is still going on today. If you look at the Oklahoma Humanities website, you will see advertised there. Let's Talk About It, Oklahoma, it's called, in public libraries in Oklahoma to this day. So I'm very proud of that program. I'm proud that it lasted this long. And the beauty of it is it gets into smaller towns where the librarians, who are extremely busy people, and you know, just really don't have to do much except advertise the program and the project director now and now I think it's run straight out of the Oklahoma Humanities office. So the program officer there helps the librarian to pick scholars to talk about the books, and then we fund the honoraria for the scholars. We also did a lot of or a number of grants for a theme development, but the NEH, National Endowment for the Humanities, itself liked the program so much, so a lot of times they funded the development of different themes as well. And then I think since I've gone, they've gotten some grants from other organizations to develop different themes. And so it's a pretty rich program, and it kind of fulfills my, I told you the last time, my dream, which that I could have as many programs in small towns as there were football games. And probably doesn't match that exactly, but it did get it to a lot of different smaller towns, humanities programs to different smaller towns. So do you have any questions? It's hard to just talk.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so these, like, new, you called them blockbuster programs that mm-hmm. the Humanities Council started trying.
Yeah.
How were they perceived by the public once they were starting to be implemented?
Well, as far as I could tell, they were really pretty popular. We got a lot of attendance. That Renaissance exhibit that I told you about drew regionally. And in fact, years later, I met a young man who actually worked at the Philbrick at the time, who told me that he became interested in art and art history because his grandparents, who lived in Kansas, had taken him to see the Renaissance exhibit. So I think it had a big impact on the region. But then the smaller programs that I'm telling about in the libraries, they were also really pretty popular. So anyway, and I guess what I'm, the point I was really trying to make is we were trying to figure out what on earth a public humanities program would be and what would people be interested in. And so we found with the help of local project directors and with the help of the National Endowment for the Humanities and our colleagues in all the other states that had humanities councils, the kinds of things that could attract an audience and be really popular. So those were the first, our first big successes. And then we continued on in those kinds of ways. As I told you before, I'm not too good on decades. But I do think it was probably in the late 80s that my colleague in North Dakota, who also had this issue of trying to figure out how to attract an audience and what is a public humanities program. And so he had a scholar in the humanities who was going to give a talk about Teddy Roosevelt, President Teddy Roosevelt. And he went with him to this project in some small town in North Dakota where he gave a lecture on something about Teddy Roosevelt. I don't know what it was exactly. And there were maybe five people in the audience that weren't with the organization that was sponsoring it. And this man was very interested in actually impersonating Teddy Roosevelt. So the next time he had him go out and talk about Teddy Roosevelt, he put on a costume and impersonated Teddy Roosevelt, and he got a huge audience. So my colleague Ev Albers from North Dakota thought, what if we did a program like that in the summertime, modeled after the Chautauquas in upstate New York. There's a town in upstate New York called Chautauqua that started these programs in the summer where they would have lecturers. And in that time, people like Teddy Roosevelt and William Jennings Bryan were actually the people that were under the tent, giving lectures and doing programs all day long. And so Ev invented the thing where he would, again, with the help of scholars, concoct a theme in American history and select characters who were prominent in like one of them was about the Civil War era, that were prominent in the Civil War era, and find scholars who were willing to take the persona of somebody in that era. And he started that in North Dakota, and it was an outrageous success. And so I heard about it and I thought, well, I'd like to do that here. So he had already started to do it also with South Dakota. So the team of people he put together in North Dakota went to South Dakota, and I thought, well, I'd like to come here. So by the time we were done, we had this program that originated actually from developed by scholars and finding the people to present the different characters. And when we ran it up the middle of the country, we would start it in Oklahoma because we started it in June and the weather is at least a little bit more moderate. And we would have these scholars in character under a big tent. And during the day, we would do programs with the scholars out of their costumes that would on different topics related to, say, the Civil War or the American Revolution or whatever theme we had that particular summer. We had started here, and then it went up through Oklahoma, Kansas, South Dakota, and Nebraska, South Dakota, and North Dakota. And by the end of August, it was up in North Dakota. And it was really, really popular. And we got it in a lot of small towns. One of them was in Frederick, Oklahoma, where the mayor was very interested in the program and applied to get it. And he found that that actually in the town, rules, I don't know what they were called. He actually saw that everybody else had to pay to use the park except for the Chautauqua, because the Chautauqua in upstate New York actually did go through the country and do these tent shows all over. So we were kind of reviving that tradition. And that was really fun. And that ran, I think, successfully into the 90s. Well, probably right straight through the 90s. And it was only after my colleague in North Dakota died that it began to wane. But in the meantime, the Tulsa Arts and Humanities Council wanted to do one of their own. So Tulsa did its own homegrown Chautauqua program and usually shared it with another community. But I don't think that's going. I'm not sure if that's going. It lasted beyond my retirement, which was in 2006. But I don't think it's still going now. I don't know for sure, but it did go for a long time and it was extremely popular. And what we found, you know, was it people are interested in history. They get more interested in history as they get older. And possibly the reason that they're not interested in history is their teachers in high school weren't very stimulating, but they are interested in our programs. The history programs that we funded were among the most popular things that we did. And of course, Let's Talk About It is really about literature, and they were popular too. So that's my experience with developing programs. And it was just a really collaborative collaborative work because it took local project directors to want to work hard, to develop an audience, to host the programs, sometimes to develop their own programs. It took a lot of scholars from all over the state to, you know, we didn't pay them much money to do the things that they did. But they willingly embraced the whole idea of presenting programs to the general public. So the biggest problem that we had once the ball got rolling, so to speak, and people like to do this, was money. Because when Ronald Reagan got into office, he had a budget director whose name I thought I would never forget, Stockton, I guess that was. Stockman, David, I don't know. I think Stockman. And he decided that he should eliminate the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities. So there was this huge scare that there wouldn't be any more funding. Well, it didn't turn out that they cut it out completely, but they cut the budget by 50%. So in doing that, the National Endowment for the Humanities cut their own funding programs to save the state humanities councils so that we would all get a significant amount of money so that we could get the doors open locally. But from that time, we had to start raising money, whatever way we could raise money. And we weren't state funded. The State Arts Council, which is funded also by the National Endowment for the Arts, is a program that became a state agency. But the National Endowment for the Humanities elected not to have state agencies. So we didn't have a line in the state budget. But we tried to get state money anyway, and periodically, every once in a while, we would get state money for some special thing. And then we had to start raising private money as well. And there I ran into a little bit of that resistance that I talked about to begin with, where people didn't trust us because we were federally funded. So there were a number of people who were potential donors who didn't really like the idea of giving to a federally funded organization. But that softened up after a while, but it took quite a bit of work. But from the 1980s, when Reagan was president, we started to have to raise money locally to get the kind of programming we wanted. The National Endowment for the Humanities has never been completely eliminated, but it has been starved a bit. And even when President Trump got into office, he wanted to cut it back, but that didn't happen. And I think that, you know, through the years when we were faced with that kind of threat, we did a lot of talking to our representatives, our Congress people, about what exactly we're doing in their states. And the people who benefited from the projects were doing a lot of that talking to their representatives too. So that the last time we were threatened, one of our Congress people told the director that it wasn't going to fly to cut the National Endowment for the Humanities or the National Endowment for the Arts, because the Congress people actually understand that this brings really fine cultural programs to the area. You know, I always used to think, you know, they go to Washington and they have all those free resources in Washington. All the museums in Washington, practically all of them, are free. They have free programs all the time for their families. But you have to do something to get those programs down in the state. So that's how I used to represent myself. You know, I just, without the funding from the NEH and the National Endowment for the Arts and the State Arts Council and Oklahoma Humanities, we wouldn't be having these programs here. It took that kind of stimulus. We generated local money too. There was always, people had to match our grants with their own in-kind resources or money that they would raise locally. So it just generated a lot of cultural activity, which wasn't available before we did our work.
Yeah. So, and after the funding for the National Endowment for the Humanities got cut and you had to start relying upon private fundraising, was the fundraising successful enough that you're able to still maintain the same level of programming that you had previously?
Yeah, we did a pretty good job. A lot of it was, we would make, for the projects themselves, especially for the big blockbuster types of programs, we would have a challenge grant to stimulate, you know, the local project people would generate a lot of local money as well for the incentive of our money. So that helped it. And then we did our own fundraising from the central office, which gradually got to be significant. Yeah. Yes, it was fairly successful. We always could use more money, because there is a need but we did well.
Okay. And, let's see what else. Were there any other sort of challenges that you had to overcome as you, during your tenure as executive director?
Well, let me see. There's always the challenge, but I think this is true in any not-for-profit organization. I remember one time the woman at the National Endowment for the Humanities who ran state programs said, "You're always looking for new staff." It seemed like we would get really good people and then they would move or take another job or something like that. So and it was a small organization. So if you've only got five or six people working for you and you lose a person, you lost a whole thing, that is not easy to replace. And then you have the idea of a new person coming in and having to train them. And then you get them trained and they get good and then they've gone. But I think that is typical of any small organization. I mean, in a larger organization, you can cope with it a little bit better, I think, than a small one, like the Humanities Councils tend to be. But so I think that's just a typical thing. But even at the NEH, that woman that ran state programs said that you were always doing that. So that was something of a challenge. But other than that, working with the National Endowment for the Humanities was always fine. They were very supportive and encouraged creativity, supported creativity. And the other wonderful thing about state humanities councils is there's such a sense of collegiality. We would have national meetings and regional meetings where we would share ideas, and it was very different from I always expected, because I have a PhD, I expected to be in academia and not doing something like this. And even though we had almost the same kind of people in this as are in academia, and a lot of a lot of people had PhDs, especially in the beginning, there wasn't that sense of rivalry. Instead, there was just a sense of collegiality where one person would help another and share ideas. And we often went to different states to talk about the programs that we were doing in our state. And I was invited once to Arkansas to talk to their board, and another time to North Dakota. Visited with councils in other states all the time, and with other directors of the councils, and shared ideas all the time. It was just a wonderful collegial atmosphere that maintained itself, I think, throughout my whole years with the Humanities Council.
Okay.
I call it the Humanities Council. It's had several different names through the years. Now they call it Oklahoma Humanities, and I can't stop saying council, so you'll have to excuse me.
Oh, it's no problem. Yeah. And so now I wanted to ask you that sort of during your time as executive director, and even afterwards, what kinds of like role and importance did you see, and do you think that the humanities, especially public humanities, have on individual lives and the importance of it in a democracy?
Well, that's a whole interesting topic. I think that, I guess it was Winston Churchill who said, "Those who don't know history are condemned to repeat it." And I really do think that's true. I think that contemporary politics shows a lack of understanding of history, that only, humanities programs can restore. But there's also the kind of the philosophical basis of democracy. I just finished not long ago reading a biography, a couple of biographies, one of Hamilton and one of Washington. And those two men who did not have the kinds of opportunities to have a lot of formal education were self-educated, and they self-educated themselves in history, in political philosophy and philosophy, which are the basis, I mean, the actual basis of this republic. Thomas Jefferson used to say that democracy cannot be sustained without an educated citizenry. And I fear that we know too little about things like history and political philosophy and philosophy in general, and just what the, American ideals, the ideals of our founding fathers were that have generated this wonderful country. I don't think we're educated, the populace at large is educated enough in that. And so I think that everything that we can do in terms of public humanities programs, but also in terms of what is taught in schools and getting people to understand that everybody should have that basis and basic literacy in history, in civics and political science and political philosophy, that will allow us to keep a vibrant democracy. That's my opinion of what's needed and why the humanities are so really important.
Okay. And during your time as executive director, did you ever have any experiences where you sort of, in a more personal manner, saw the like impact that these public humanities programs had on the people of Oklahoma?
Well, you know, I think I told you about that one story, meeting that young man at the Philbrook who had had a career in museums, actually, because he'd gone to that exhibit when he was a kid. Another time, I was visiting a school where we had a pretty successful traveling exhibit program, and this particular program was on Indian games. It was put together by somebody with the Oklahoma Museum of Natural History, and it was about the Indian games that now you know, we have lacrosse teams. That lacrosse game was its ancestor is an Indian game. Anyway, so this exhibit explained that. And these exhibits mainly toured to school libraries, but also to regular libraries. But I brought my project director down to a school in Norman where we had this exhibit. And the librarian was there, opened up the library to show her. And then she told us this story about how the teachers in the different grades brought the students in to look at this exhibit. And one young boy with Indian heritage looked at this exhibit and he said, "My grandfather makes those things, makes the kind of scooper that scoops up the ball in lacrosse. He said, my grandfather makes those. My grandfather makes those." And he had been a really not a student that was not interested in school much, kind of, you know, wasn't paying too much attention. And he began to bring his friends into the school library to show them that exhibit so that they could see the thing that his grandfather made. And he got more interested in school. I mean, it is kind of, and there she is telling my state program project director this about the effectiveness of my program in that school, you know. So it was really funny. Those were really personal, change lives kind of stories. Other than that, you know, people were very receptive. And even after I retired, I kept meeting people from, you know, occasionally from various areas in Oklahoma who we remembered things like the Chautauquas and stuff like that. So I think it does make a difference. And you never can tell, especially with children, what is going to change their whole attitude towards everything to do with studying history or literature or something. You never can tell what's going to do that. And those are just two little stories I can remember.
Yeah, those are great. And so do you have any favorite or particularly memorable memories or experiences from your time as executive director?
Well, some of my fondest memories have to do with some of the people that I had on my board and the relationships that I had with them, and the kind of what would you call it? Their devotion to serving the Humanities Council was really and truly amazing, and their support of me was amazing. You know, I came to working for the Humanities Council never expecting to be an administrator, never expecting to run budgets or fundraise or anything like that. All the things that I fell into, I didn't know a thing about. I got a PhD in history and thought that I would teach all my life and do research and write books. And there I was in a completely different state from where I was raised. And if it wasn't for those board members, it would have been a lot harder to learn what to do or how to do it. One of my, I had originally in the first couple of years, I had two mentors. One was the chairman, and he was Dean of Arts and Sciences down at Norman. And his name was Paige Mulholland, and he taught me a lot about being an administrator. And the other one was Lee Bronner, who was the director of the Metropolitan Library System in Oklahoma City. And he was a super administrator, and he taught me a lot about being an administrator. And then, you know, through the years, I had other board members who were very helpful with fundraising and just really had my own little kind of tutorials with with individual board members, and helped me through a lot of periods that were, you know, completely befuddling to somebody who was really trained, so to speak, to do research in archives, you know, and not to run an organization or fundraise or do anything like that. So I had a lot of really good help from my board members. And I have to say that there was a, my husband used to call it, because he was a sociologist, he used to call it the kind of board spirit or something like that, but, and he used more a sociological word, and it was always one of being helpful and not obstructive, but just let's see what we can do to move this project along. It was their general attitude. And if it meant helping me out, understanding the best methods of administration or of fundraising or of anything, they were there for it. And really, really kind people. And they had a spirit of collaboration with each other that was remarkable as well. So I think that, you know, when I think about it, that was those memories of particular board members, several of whom now have died, are among my fondest memories.
All right. And, well, we've more or less covered the things that I wanted to. So is there anything else that wish to share?
Yeah, let me tell you also, I did tell you that people at BNEH were very nice too, but there were a couple of them that were really mentors for me as well. Because when we first started doing this, as I said, nobody knew what they were doing, even the program officers. And so there were, we were definitely working together, and so I have a lot of good memories of the people who were in state programs at the NEH as well, and other people in the different areas of NEH who were so really helpful and encouraging to me. So in all, I think it was a really great experience, not one that I expected to have in my life, but was personally delightful. And not only all of those things, but also what I got to learn because of all the people with a state program in their area was I got to meet people from not only all the states of the United States. I knew somebody in every state of the United States, but I also knew somebody in all the territories. So I knew people from American Samoa and Guam and all these, but you know, I mean, it was really fascinating to go to a national meeting and meet all these people who are trying to do the same thing. So it's a wonderful movement almost that you could call it to, that is nationwide and not only in the states per se, but in the territories.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think that pretty much covers it. So
yes, it does.
Yeah.
I don't have anything more to say.
All right. Well then, all right. Thank you so much again for doing these interviews with me.